Our United Healthcare Community and State Newsletter is your go-to source for the latest Medicaid news and United Healthcare programs serving Medicaid beneficiaries. Subscribe now by visiting our website at uhccs.com/newsletter. Stay in the know by gaining access to our latest blogs, educational videos, and upcoming events. At United Healthcare, our mission is to help people live healthier lives and make the health system work better for everyone in local communities across the U.S.
Thanks for joining Health Affairs This Week. I'm Babin Watts.
And I'm Ryan Tanak.
You'll continue to hear from us throughout the year with podcast episodes focused on health equity. But before we start, be sure to check out our Ahead of Print article that will be featured in our August issue, entitled Early OxyContin Marketing Linked to Long-Term Spread of Infectious Disease Associated with Injection Drug Use.
Also, don't forget to check out a new 7-part article series from Forefront on the private sector solutions for health equity, sponsored by CVS Health. Really excited about this series. The last article comes out today, babe, and it covers private sector's role in advancing health equity, private-public partnerships, and topics such as cardiovascular health, mental health, and maternal health.
It's pretty interesting.
Absolutely. So I guess just to start us off, I'd love to recognize some recent events and cultural observances that we had in the past couple of months, babe.
Yeah. So, you know, it's the summertime, and, you know, the summer kicked off with Pride Month. You know, a lot of people know that Pride Month is celebrated in June, but pretty much don't know the background of it. So here it is. So, you know, actually on June 28th, 1969, the NYPD raided the Stonewall Inn. It was a bar frequented by LGBTQ folks. Raids on LGBTQ-friendly bars were not uncommon. However, this raid was met with resistance and resulted in a 6-day riot, igniting the modern-day gay rights movement. 1 year later, the riots were commemorated on June 28, 1970, with a march. Over time, that annual march became known as the Gay Pride Parade. And eventually, June was designated as Gay and Lesbian Pride Month by President Bill Clinton. And the rest is history.
Speaking of history, really quick, that's not history that we learn about in school.
Oh, it's not at all history that we learn about in school or really elsewhere.
And so I guess just thinking about Pride and as we, you know, see how that affect how, you know, the LGBTQIA plus community has been affected, like at least since the beginning of the year, one thing that I noticed, and maybe you and I had been talking about, is the amount of anti-LGBTQIA plus legislation that's been introduced.
Yes, you know, so this year, so Pride, you know, started from a movement, and we know that movements, for the most part, have some type of advocacy that goes along with that. But I would say this year was different. I did participate in the Pride festivities in Baltimore in June. And the advocacy at Pride was strong due to the fact that in 2023 alone, there were more than 525 anti-LGBTQ bills introduced by the start of June. Approximately 1/3 of these bills introduced were related to healthcare, mainly legislation aiming to block transgender youth from getting gender-affirming care was the most prevalent among those bills related to healthcare. So, you know, this year Pride was different. I mean, there were other things that that actually came up as far as like education was number one as it relates to the anti-LGBTQ bills. But then that was quickly followed by anti-health LGBTQ bills. So it's really interesting. I would say the turn of events that are going on within the LGBTQ community. I know a couple of weeks ago on the episode of This Week, they said for LGBTQ legislation, it seems like it was moving two steps forward and two steps back. So it'd be interesting to see how, you know, actually at the end of the year, how many anti-LGBTQ bills will be introduced, considering the fact that by June, 525 were introduced.
And that's a big increase from previous years. And one of the things you just mentioned is that a lot of that legislation also is related to education. And for example, not being able to discuss LGBTQ topics in the classroom. But another thing I wanted to point out that happened at the end of Pride Month was the case related to affirmative action and how the Supreme Court essentially ruled that race-conscious admissions in Harvard and UNC are unconstitutional?
Yes, they did rule that these were unconstitutional. That actually happened on June 29th. The Supreme Court rules race-conscious admissions policies at Harvard as well, which is one of the oldest private institutions here in the United States. And UNC, one of the biggest public institutions here in the United States, are unconstitutional, ending affirmative action.
I think it'd be helpful to kind of discuss the history of affirmative action. I think a lot of people it's a little bit murky, the history, kind of understanding the ebbs and flows, and I'd love to talk about that. So I guess going back to the late 70s, there was a case between the Regents of the University of California versus Bakke. And that ultimately allowed colleges to consider race in admissions, as long as, racial quotas were not a part of that. And then in one of the more recent ones in 2016 was Fisher versus the University of Texas, where an individual named Abigail Fisher sued the University of Texas. She's a white woman. And she argued that the use of race was a violation of the 14th Amendment. But ultimately, the case upheld previous cases that it is constitutional. So I think just in the, less than a decade, we're seeing, like you said, a lot of change in legislation, and specifically as it relates to education. But I'd love to hear your thoughts, Vabe, on, what do you think the implications of this recent case are for health equity?
Yeah, so interesting. So I will say, having worked in the medical education space for a while, I did work with the Association of American Medical Colleges. They did the altering the course, trying to get more actually Black men into medicine. They looked at data that compared 1975 to 2015, and they found out that there were actually less Black men entering into medical school in 2015 than it was in 1975. And so, with this being said, as we, one of the key pillars actually deals with workforce diversity. And that workforce diversity includes making sure that you do have physicians and other healthcare workers that are represented who are going into areas of different cultures. That does make a difference, having someone who can provide not only medical care, but who also can relate to your experience as a person who identifies as a particular race within America. And when I worked with, that aspect, it was looking from, the mental health aspect of things, where, it is important. Well, at least for me, I'm going to speak for myself, where it is important, where, when I do look for a therapist or a physician who may, be able to help with behavioral mental health needs, that I prefer someone to have a background that I may have. I may look for a male one. I may look for a Black male. I may look for a person who is LGBTQ, but then sometimes I don't get that. So I may, choose, a male. It is usually always a male, but the male may be a racial ethnic minoritized group, but things along like going to someone who I do not have to explain my experience living as a Black man in America or a gay man in America. So all those things are important. And, if we look at, you know, we're already having problems with really diversifying medical schools, and, you know, and this will, you know, hamper, it, well, it allegedly, you know, hampers health equity. This could be a major problem. And we'll see how this pans out.
No, absolutely. I think your experience and also my experience as a, you know, woman of color, Asian American, you know, seeking care, it's so important to have culturally competent providers. And also it would be, at least from my perspective, ideal to have somebody that I identify with. So I think going off of that, you mentioned mental health, which is a perfect transition. This month, July, is B.B. Moore Campbell National Minority Mental Health Month.
Yes.
And B.B. Moore Campbell was an author, a journalist, a mental health advocate, and she was actually one of the co-founders of NAMI Urban Los Angeles. NAMI is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. So she was really focused on, you know, reducing that stigma within communities of color and encouraging people to get care, mental health care. So, I mean, like you said, cultural competence is so important in healthcare, and specifically in minority mental health. A lot of different communities face added barriers. One is the Muslim American community. According to the American Psychiatric Association, nearly one third Muslim Americans experience religious discrimination in a healthcare setting. So that's something to keep in mind when you're thinking about, okay, we can encourage communities of color and historically marginalized communities to access care, but once they get there, what is their experience like?
Exactly. And you really have to incorporate that culture into care, particularly as you look at indigenous populations. Their way of providing mental health care, it may be totally different from, you know, from how it is provided among other groups and ethnicity, because they are really into being connected to the land. So, you know, the conventional, you know, therapy that we use, they may not use that because they want to get receive a therapy that is respectful of their culture.
Oh, absolutely. And in indigenous populations, American Indians, Alaskan Natives, they have higher rates of mental illness compared to the general population in the U.S. And a lot of that is linked to intergenerational historical trauma and all of those aspects. So like you said, Vabe, it's really important to have that culturally competent care, because not every community is the same. You know, there's no one size fits all approach for the different populations, especially as it relates to mental health.
Correct. And, you know, Ryan, you know, I think this year also, we just hit the one mark anniversary of the hotline, speaking of mental health, of the hotline number for suicide prevention.
Oh, yes, 988. That is a number that will connect you to crisis prevention services in your local community. So they essentially route you to, you know, a crisis counselor if you're experiencing suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation, and you're in crisis, or if you're somebody you know is and you want to know how to support them, that is a great resource to call.
So I would say over these past couple of months, health equity has been front and center, it seems like. I don't think I realized that until we started talking, you know, more about everything that has been going on. But, you know, of course, you know, you know, in our podcast, be sure to check out the show notes, and you'll be able to go to some links and resources that we're talking about today. And also, as we begin to wrap up, reiterate, be sure to check out our August issue of Health Affairs coming soon, plus our CVS sponsored Forefront series on health equity.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Health Affairs this week with Vabren Watts and myself. So if you like the episode, tell a friend, leave a review, or subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Goodbye.
Bye.